Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody. How are you doing this week? Chris Jordan here, host of the Curious Realm, coming at you live from Austin, Texas. Hope everybody's been doing great. Thank you so much for always tuning in. Hey, before we get started tonight, make sure to stop on by the People's Choice Podcast Awards and vote for Curious Realm right over my shoulder here on top of my tchotchke shelf is actually my People's Choice Podcast Award for News and Politics for Dudes and Beer. We are up for the same category this year, so stop on by, vote for us. Thank you for everybody that voted last year, and thank you for everybody who tunes in every week and everybody who is part of the Facebook group that we pull stories from and that we, yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask what the group is really about. And just to give you a little insight, back in the day when the show was just myself and two friends, it was really a private three-person group that was there for us to throw stories into to go like, hey, read about this because I want to talk about this week, stuff like that. So that was kind of the progeneration of the Facebook group. And as we grew, we opened that group up to the public and let people start sharing their own stuff. And it's been great. It's been a fantastic conversation. We have just over 1,000 members in the group. We have, I guess, almost 8,000 followers on our Facebook page right now. But it has been great to see the growth of the community there. And even to hear people over COVID say, over the pandemic, that it was one of the only groups that they were in where things did not become toxic among members, and that conversations still happen. So kudos to all you guys out there for that, because it is you guys that make that conversation happen. So thank you for that. And thank you for always tuning in. Thank you for always listening. Tonight, we will be talking here in just a few minutes with our good friend Daniel Island Jones. He is going to be speaking this weekend at the Wonderland UFO Festival right down the road near San Antonio. So we'll be talking about the UFO case out of Aurora, Texas, a very famous case where supposedly there might be a body buried in a cemetery. There have been all kinds of rumors, things like that. And he has a new book coming out about Aurora. So we will be talking about the Aurora UFO crash of 1897 in the first part of the show. After commercial break, we will be welcoming our good friend Todd Cochran, the owner of Blueberry Podcasting. And you may be saying, like, why are you having somebody about podcasting on? Here's the thing. A lot of people do not realize whenever you go and just download an app, you don't always read that end user license agreement. You don't always see what data they are swathing from you. And, you know, especially whenever you're talking about free services, whenever you're talking about services where people host their show and the service is free, beware, folks, because ain't nothing free. Guaranteed that they are scraping data and your private data and your cookies and everything else. And that is what they are selling. So we will be getting into the touchy world of privacy and podcasting and how the onus really, really falls on us, the creators, to encourage you guys to go to proper platforms to find our shows. And if you find them on other platforms that are giving that data away, or you find out that a platform that we're on, hey, come to us. Like I say in the pre-recorded segment with Todd, that's the whole reason why our app is not up on stores and everything else. I don't want you to have to surrender your data to get that. So our app is a sideload. Sorry, Apple folks, you can't sideload an app onto an Apple device, so you don't get it. I'm not buying into that system again. So Yeah, we're going to be getting into privacy and podcasting and how you, the consumer, need to be aware and vigilant with what is going on with your data. Before we bring on our guests, let's, of course, hop on over to the internet. Thank you so much to our good friends at WebWorks Wireless. They are providers for all of our website live streams. For those of you who tune in every week to our live website streams on CuriousRealm.com, thank you so much, WebWorks Wireless. Also, thank you to our good friend and sponsor, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge. She is your number one source for frequency healing, alternative health, and consciousness expansion exercises. SecretOfEverything.com is her website. Our website is Curious Realm. Do not forget to stop on by and go to CuriousRealm.com/story. And you can share your account of the paranormal. If you're a targeted individual, you can remain anonymous. Tell us if you've had an alien abduction, a cryptid sighting, a near-death experience. If you've been part of classified or black ops programs and want to whistleblow, there's a spot there where you can upload your pictures, your videos, upload documents that you have, things like that. So stop on by, share your story with us. And if you aren't really an internet user and you're kind of an old school person like myself and you enjoy a phone, you can call in the Experiencer hotline. 512-298-3913 is the phone number. 512-298-3913. All of these stories, once again, will remain anonymous if you so ask. But we're opening that up. We want to start doing some experiencer episodes. We want to start doing some episodes where the stories are sourced from you guys, the audience. And when we talk to people like Sev Talk, who is, you know, a regional investigator for MUFON, we can share these stories with them and get their professional feedback about them. So stop on by, share your story. While you're there, of course, make sure to stop on by and join the Facebook group. That is where we pull our news of the week from. Let's see what has been happening in the news this week. A drone that flew over 2 months in a U.S. Army test has crashed in Arizona after nearly breaking a record for the longest flight time. That out of Yahoo News. Out of CNBC, 10 common phrases that make you sound passive-aggressive in the workplace. This is an interesting one. Out of Futurism, major record label signs virtual rapper who is actually an AI. The artist FN Mika, a virtual rapper with over 10 million followers on TikTok. Out of Vice.com, Congress admits UFOs not, quote, man-made, says, quote, threats increasing, quote, exponentially. Out of Medium.com, footage captured a possible UFO swarm over Hawaii. That was an article by Ryan Sprague. There's another one about the virtual rapper. And I enjoyed this one out of Tom's Hardware. Samsung Germany RMA suggests drilling or smashing an SSD with a hammer in order to permanently remove all data and assure the fact that you have cleared the hard drive. So that is just some of the news that is out there right now on Facebook, on the Curious Realm group. Make sure to stop on by, join the group, follow the page. And while you're online, make sure to stop on by the Vortex on YouTube. Vortex is the work of Daniel Allen Jones, our guest for this segment. Welcome back to the show, my friend. How have you been?
Hey, Chris. Great to be here with you again and doing well. I'm looking forward to all the events coming up here for the remainder of the year and working on getting this new book out on the Aurora legend of 1897.
I am highly excited for your book. I am anticipating the how is that going, by the way? How close are you? Do you have a to print date or anything yet?
Well, I'm aiming for early November or late October, because I had to add some additions from things I really just found out here not too long ago, a few weeks back, because there's an ongoing issue in the town of Aurora, and it's something that I think is definitely worth including in this chronology, because what I'm what I'm really writing is not exactly a fictionalized version or just the story of what happened with this supposed incident back over 100 years ago. It's really taking the legend itself and showing how it's been embedded in media, newspapers, magazines, investigative work done all throughout the century. And so it's something I think that's going to be a different take on the whole thing, rather than a lot of the things that have been done on it so far. So there's a lot happening. I'm looking at maybe later in October, maybe around Halloween. I'm going to think about how that can be something maybe it would be fun to try to get out for that. So we'll see. But yeah, later this year.
Yeah, yeah. And it is an interesting case. I've actually got the original article clip up on screen right now. And I will be putting this into our knowledge vault as well. This is the actual JPEG of the news article. But let's start really cracking the nut on the case that is the Aurora UFO.
Right. Well, as you can see there in the small clipping, you know, it's an interesting but somewhat short story, because if you have the entire page, which is actually the fifth page of at the time, the Dallas Morning Herald, officially became the Dallas Morning News, it was one of many airship stories embedded on that page. This one is sort of centrally located in the middle column, and surrounding it were all of these other stories of what they called the airship. The title of the page was The Great Aerial Wanderer, and they were dealing with this issue, which at the time was referred to as the Great Airship Mystery, which has been written about and explored in many different capacities. But I think it's really interesting that it's not necessarily an isolated event. There were other airship sightings all throughout both the Midwest and in Texas as well. This one, I think, is probably the most notable, because not only was it a sighting or something that seemed more or less human-like, in that it was maybe just an advanced blimp or Zeppelin or some kind of air balloon, but it really seems like the story of what they refer to as a spaceship and its pilot goes far beyond maybe what most people would think of would be acceptable at the time, and touches upon some otherworldly issues. Because as you can see in the paper, it talks about how S.E. Hayden wrote this article describing that an object crashed down into Judge J.S. Proctor's windmill and exploded, sending debris scattering. And unfortunately, if it happens as it was described, the remains of the pilot were found as well. And so it's really unfortunate to think that if there was a person on board, whether it was a real alien or just a human or whoever it was, or if there was anything at all, that they succumbed to their injuries.
Yeah.
But the people thought enough of it to gather up the remains. And as it says, enough were gathered to determine that it was, quote, not an inhabitant of this world.
Yeah. Yeah. It says specifically the pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one on board. And while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original had been picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world.
Right.
That's pretty remarkable.
I think so, at least for the time. And it's one of the things I think that stands out, because science fiction really wasn't all that big at that time, although it's not to say it didn't exist at all, because the following year,
sure,
you have a lot of different things happening, War of the Worlds and all these issues.
Yeah.
Which later, essentially.
Well, you had the writings of Jules Verne. You had, Edgar Allan Poe, all kinds of folks who had written many works about science fiction, that kind of stuff. Because this was 1897, correct? When
right,
the crash actually happened.
April 17th, 1897, the newspaper article is written 2 days later, and it supposedly was a repeat of something printed in what was known as the Aurora paper, or Aurora newspaper, which is really hard to determine if there was actually such a paper with this story.
Mm.
But in my research, I have found that there was an Aurora newspaper. There was something called the Aurora Lights, interestingly enough, which wasn't necessarily about actual lights being seen as in like a UFO phenomenon, but rather they just referred to this paper, this early publication of the 1800s as the Aurora Lights. And this later changed over into another publication. But the idea was that this story was carried and that S.E. Hayden was a stringer for the Dallas Morning News and actually just repeated the story. But as it continues on, it says that a signal services officer of the Army named T.J. Weems thought it was of his opinion, that they thought also he was an authority on astronomy, that he was an inhabitant of the planet Mars. And this is a prevalent idea at this time where Martians really kind of became part of the pop culture. And so it's an interesting inclusion. And they also described that papers were found that described his travels that were written in some indecipherable hieroglyphics, which is really interesting. But this also is highly speculative and one of those parts of the story that throws it into a very suspicious area. So while it's fun to think of all these different parts of what makes the story unique, it's a big challenge to legitimizing by way of hard evidence for what exists now, because what they basically continue to say and what was also written in another publication called the Fort Worth Register was that the remains were gathered and there was a formal burial down the road at the local Aurora Cemetery. This is a Masonic cemetery. And this actually, it doesn't really describe this very well. And a lot of people are confused about this whole issue, but I've met a lot of people who know something about the story. They say, oh, that's the story about the UFO crash and the windmill or the well or the alien in the grave and all of this. There's a lot to it, and I've met a lot of people who know something, bits and pieces of the story. But essentially, in Aurora and in Wythe County, there was this grave, a cemetery that had to be moved near the turn of the century. And all the bodies that were taken down were attempted to be accounted for. And there was a man named Tap Flimp, who was a big advocate for the local church. And so he kept track of a lot of the bodies being transferred from cemetery to cemetery. And apparently there was, there are obviously discretions with this whole story. So the challenge is if this supposed pilot was buried in the original cemetery, if it ever got transferred to the new cemetery in the early 1900s. And the challenge also with that is that there is supposedly an unmarked grave, which seems to be the one everyone thinks that this pilot was buried, but it would have had to have been transferred early on, still over 100 years ago. So they apparently gave it a formal Christian burial. And, it's said that maybe it was a small stature being.
Yeah, I like the Christian burial for the... for the dude from Mars, it is such a strange and interesting case, Daniel, that there we were pre-1900s, and like you said, the entire page of the Dallas Morning News, this was just the middle article amongst things.
The front page.
What's that?
It was like the fifth page in. Yeah. It wasn't even like the front headlines,
Yeah, exactly. But the whole page was covered with stories of airships. And let's start getting a little bit into one of the things that I brought up in our pre-show conversation. I actually went and tracked down and found the rules and regulations for the Aurora Cemetery Association. I put those up on our knowledge vault. If you go into the knowledge vault into the UFO and paranormal area, it is the last document on that page. But if you go down, and this is just the generalized rules of the cemetery associations in Aurora. But if you go to the third page here, you will see the definitions of grave or lot or vault, interment, entrenchment, earth burial or entombment, and then right there, internment for human remains only. No internment of any body or the cremated remains of anybody other than that of a human being shall be permitted in the cemetery. I thought that that was really interesting. I'm sure that they do that to make sure that somebody doesn't like bury their dog with them, things like that. But I found it a very, very interesting concept. that they specifically spelled out in their terms. Now, let's get a little bit more into the moving of that cemetery and the many cases of, I guess, exhumation that have gone on in attempts to prove this story.
Right. Well, throughout the years, you know, you made a good point about how earlier it's something that, you know, it took place before the 1900s, and you don't even have the Wright brothers until 1903 with City Hockey of the yep. Flyers, right? So this wasn't really something that seems like it makes sense in the conventional scope of history and what we think of as modern aviation. There doesn't seem that there should have been anything in the sky around that time, although there are a lot of other interesting alternative ideas about inventors and groups of, you know, secretive clubs of scientists and people, you know, trying to make some flying ships and arrows, as they were called. But aside from all of this, it is interesting to consider that this doesn't really describe something like that. It's more or less dealing with what we now call something more or less like a UFO with aliens. And so obviously they didn't refer to it as a UFO or an alien back then. They actually just said spaceship and pilot, and that it's possibly a Martian. Because yeah. Martians were in the nomenclature, they were in the pop culture. And so I also was really going into a deep dive of the trope of the little green men, mm-hmm. which stems far beyond its association with extraterrestrials. But in the early 1900s, it started to gain that connotation. So I looked into all the different references I could find where little green men were used as a connection to aliens, and how that and Martians really played a big part in science fiction and in early storytelling up through, the teens, the 20s, the 30s and 40s, up until the 50s, you don't really have a lot of talk about the sort of modern iconography of aliens being the grays. And even now, the green alien, the little green men trope is still very popular. So what's really interesting about all of this is that, as you mentioned with the Christian burial rites and how that element of the story adds an interesting aspect, I think that what you see happening throughout the years is the popularization of the UFO phenomenon from basically the end of World War II, the beginning of the 50s, you go through into the 60s and 70s, and it was huge. It was a really big, fun idea for a lot of people to contemplate on the reality that these UFOs, and now what we call today UAP, could possibly be alien spaceships or some type of being from another world. And so this whole idea about this story taking place now, 125 years ago, seems a little out of place, out of context, but it was there. And so what's really interesting is that the story of the Martians continue on throughout that time to kind of be inspirational towards story writing, storytelling with science fiction and pop culture throughout the years. So with this idea of this Aurora spaceman, as he's sometimes referred to, it was talked about in local areas and in this sort of local region up here close to where I am in different ways up into the 50s and 60s. It was sort of a local legend until it got a little bit of notoriety that somewhat of the old timers started to say, you know what, this story got a lot of attention. And the challenge is that there's not a lot about the whole issue from the teens into the 20s into the 30s, but there are some interesting notions about what happened in the 40s and 50s. I was able to locate some handwritten documents about people that went into schools in Wise County, in which Aurora was within, that were interviewing people that lived in Aurora at the time that date back into the 50s and earlier. And it wasn't actually written about more widespread until the 60s. And probably about 67, 68, there were some local writers for the Star-Telegram and other publications that started to look into this a little bit more seriously, but in a way that was still very detracting and saying this is all just a tall tale and a story and pretty much a hoax, which is still seen that way today, and that's understandable, but there are still some people who think it's the smoking gun and the real deal. And I think it's important to showcase that I'm not advocating for either of those positions personally, much less just saying that there are various ways in which this has been perceived throughout the years, and I'm just showing how it's been looked at all throughout that time, and that people can make a decision if they want to themselves, but that's also not really the angle I'm pushing either. It's because I think the story involves a lot of ideas about what we now, today in ufology, in modern ufology, are trying to find exactly what the original story describes. And the whole idea about this body got enough attention that throughout the end of the 60s, a lot of UFO investigators ended up finding this particular case interesting and looking back into those airship mysteries of the late 1800s, namely J. Allen Hynek, Jacques Vallée, a number of other people involved with the UFO Investigation Bureau, MUFON, and different organizations, some of which are defunct now. But it garnered enough attention that people started to look more seriously because of Project Blue Book at maybe earlier instances of aerial phenomena. So it's particularly interesting to me because this shows that this is not just a modern frenzy or craze that people are only noticing happened in the last half century, but actually goes well beyond the whole entire century. And so the idea was that it garnered enough attention by these enthusiasts and treasure hunters and UFO investigators that they descended upon Aurora, and the town basically exploded with people trying to figure out where this body was buried in the cemetery. And this is now where the cemetery is today. This is all amounting to 1973, where closing in on the anniversary in 73, you have several people come out. You have aviation writer for the Dallas Morning News, the same newspaper in which the original story was written, as well as the Texas chapter head for MUFON, Bill Case. He came out there, and along with him was my friend, the late Jim Mars, who was there on the scene looking in the cemetery along with other investigators who basically uncovered the whereabouts of this grave, which seemed to have an unmarked location with a headstone that was sort of a rough rock, this sort of rigid stone with an engraving that showed some strange marking. They determined that this was likely to be the burial site of this Aurora spaceman. And because of this, they specifically Hayden Hughes of the UFO Investigation Bureau from Oklahoma, they launched a legal pursuit to exhume the body, doing so legally, you know, trying to not really break any rules and seeing what they could do to ascertain the fate of the spaceman and the case overall, because they were able to find bits of metal and pieces of this supposed material that came from the explosion of this cigar-shaped metallic craft, as it was written. And so all of this material seems to have somehow very conveniently disappeared. A lot of it was said to have been discarded down the well. The windmill was connected to a well and water tower, and whatever remained was either gathered and hauled off, or people kept it as trinkets, or it was buried with the spaceman. So in 73, an official attempt was made to exhume the body to determine once and for all what the deal was with this supposed Martian. In doing so, the Cemetery Association countered with a suit saying, we will take anyone to court, basically, and threaten with a lawsuit. Anyone who comes digging, comes into the cemetery with a shovel, and does anything of the sort. So it was immediately put to a standstill and ultimately a halt of the investigation. And right after this decision was made, a night watch was brought up at the cemetery for a number of weeks. The odd thing about this night watch was that as soon as it was done, the headstone, which was perceived to be the original headstone, went missing, and there were three strange drill marks at the site of the grave.
Wow. Wow. And yeah, I was trying to bring up the reward offered for the headstone from the Texas Star Telegram. Paywalled. But it is an absolutely interesting case, like you said, that not only did it vanish, but that there were drill holes there, as though somebody was trying to probe down and see what might be there. Has there been, at least as far as you know, any other, through your research, any other attempts to, like, radar map the spot or anything like that?
Yeah, you know, so throughout the years after that, that really put an end to probably the largest investigation with that effort made. And again, this is now half a century ago when that happened. You know, we're talking coming up on 50 years ago next year that the attempt was made to go and legally be able to have an exhumation of the supposed Martian body. And unfortunately, no attempt has ever been done on such a scale, although other attempts have been made to find what they can without actually any type of invasive breaching of the soil or digging, much less, you know, just hauling a shovel out and just doing what you can to just get it out. I don't know that anyone hasn't done that. It seems like it's very feasible that anyone at any time could go into, you know, quite frankly, any cemetery and start digging away. And that's obviously not something that I'm, you know, advocating, but it's one of those things you know, is it really
don't
worth it?
That.
Yeah. But
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely something that has crossed my mind when I'm there every single time. I'm thinking, you know, anyone could easily start digging away here. I don't know that it's happened, but I will say that throughout the years, since all of that, that actually set off a whole advent of new articles being written about it from just every major news publication and news outlet. Even the New York Times published a piece on this. And so different people over the years and out throughout that time, it became quite a sensation. And so some of the old timers who were still around came forward and said it happened. It didn't happen. Mary Evans was one of them. Charlie Stevens was another. Mary said that it didn't happen. Charlie said that it did. It's still divided. And though that investigation was launched in 73, after that headstone went missing, which this is Jim Mars, he said that the shape of the engravement or engraving on the stone seemed to indicate that it might have been broken off from a full stone and that maybe it was just half of what was originally there, that if you completed the other half, would have maybe looked like the spaceship. And that's also curious, but with the drill holes, he asked Bill Case what he thought and or who did it, and Bill Case told Jim the government. And Bill Case unfortunately passed away a year after that. But going down the line throughout history into the 70s and 80s, it got enough attention that a movie was made about it, a fictionalized story, and it was sort of a B and maybe even C film. And it's a fun watch, but they used a small boy with progeria to depict the alien who, not to, you know, spoiler alert, I guess, he didn't crash on impact and die. He got out and interacted with the townsfolk and, you know, had a good time. And ultimately they had to do away with him at the end of the movie. So that was a fun portrayal in 86. And going into the 90s, you come upon 97, the 100th anniversary.
Yep.
And another sort of investigation was launched by a few different people and groups. And Jim came back out. And around this time, he was really interested in looking back into the case and kind of how it resurfaced into, you know, at the time, ufology sort of got back up in popularity.
Yeah.
And the issue with this whole thing is that people came out throughout this whole time with metal detectors and probably in many ways, scooped up what they could they found anything at all, whether it was old farm tools and equipment, because again, this is a Western, you know, town. So there definitely is stuff like that.
Oh,
but
absolutely.
People are hauling off anything they can because if they knew about the story, they knew it was there. So again, it drew the attention of a lot of treasure hunters, so to speak, and that who weren't really as interested in maybe just the alien, but trying to get their hands on anything they could. So who knows if there is still anything left, but I've heard stories of people saying that he had seen bits of the metal. Some of the metal had strange hieroglyphics on it, that it was soft and silvery and very lightweight. But to the point of if anyone else has really come out, the History Channel actually did after the a few years after the 100th anniversary in the early 2000s. And they basically just did what they could to look into the crash site and the burial site. They were not allowed to get on to the crash site and uncover the well up until a few years later. They came back. And so while there was a documentary put out about the Aurora incident in the early 2000s, they got to come back a few years later with a new show they were doing called the UFO Hunters. And this is actually probably the other biggest investigation that was launched, where they got to use ground penetrating radar over the gravesite, which they determined was basically they found an indication of a small child sized grave, but they weren't able to determine what was contained within it.
Yeah. And you know, let's visit the idea of the crash site real quick, because let's start getting into the aftermath, or at least the supposed aftermath, to the good judge and family and people. What was the aftermath for these folks? Because as it said, there was stuff that made it into the well, possibly. Scattered all around the property. So were there any ill health effects, anything like that, that were suffered by those folks on the property or nearby, or people that occupied the property afterward?
You know, Chris, that's a really great question. And there's a few things that I think I found that were really clarifying in this whole issue, because with how we look at the modern study of UFOs today and the big issues of UAP, there are a lot of issues concerning being within close proximity to UAP, you know, and the effects of the physiological effects of such encounters. And so what we've seen with this particular case is quite interesting, because the original judge, so to speak, and it turns out that he wasn't actually a judge, that was just a nickname. His name was James Spencer Proctor, and the property that this crash happened on was on his homestead. And it also, apparently, as the newspaper article states, it ruined his flower garden, unfortunately. So I'm sure that it ruined much more than that if it actually happened. But I just think it's a bit amusing that they included that. So at some point, a new family moved onto the property who had been in the area for some time within Wise County. This is the Oates family. And the father figure of the Oates family was Brawley Oates. And the Oates family didn't really know anything about the story as it seems, because they found out that through people coming on their property and wanting to view the remains of the well and the wreckage, that apparently because of the amount of material that was thrown down the well, they, the Oates family, wanted to use the well for drinking. And it seems that this family ended up having much of the material that was discarded down the well hauled off, taken out, and clean so that it could use the well for drinking. Now, the Oates family apparently did this and used the well for a number of years, maybe about 10 to 12 years. And they ended up with some really bad ailments, specifically what looks like some really bad cases of arthritis, where their hands got really big and very abnormal. And there are pictures of this as well. And there are historic records of the Oates family having lived in Wise County. So we know that a lot of these different people can be traced back in documentation. And unfortunately, while that may be the case, I don't think there's any medical records to substantiate the claim that they succumbed to this illness, because of what Brawley Oates specifically said was that poisoned well water because of that spaceship crash and that pilot. And so while this person apparently claimed that they were suffering the effects because of this story, I don't know that there's anything to validate that. It does seem particularly interesting, if not curious, to wonder if there was a crash and this metal was put in a well and they did drink from it, would they have suffered such adverse effects? And unfortunately, they had effects either way, whether it did or not. But the Oates family definitely seems to have some type of ill effects from this, and or from drinking the well or having something happen either way. And this went on until the 40s, where later on, from the 40s into the 70s, the Oates family, Brawley Oates, came forward, and as he was much older at the time, basically attested to this being a result from this crash. And so it's very unfortunate if that is the case or not, either way. But in that History Channel special on the UFO Hunters episode, they sent Pat Uskert, a guy who I've got to meet on a few occasions years ago, they sent him down that well to see if there was any more material down there. And unfortunately, they weren't able to get anything. And some of my my friends and colleagues and people I've worked with before, Ken Cherry and Steve Hudgens, who at the time were with MUFON, they launched this investigation with the History Channel to go and see if they could uncover the well, which had been sealed up since all of that, and put a basically like a well house, an outhouse type of building over it. They removed all of that. They sent Pat Uskert down the well. He couldn't find anything. Unfortunately, he came back up empty-handed. They did find a snake that apparently fell down there, and they let the snake go. I thought it might have been interesting to test the snake, but, you know, nothing came of that. But that's essentially what we see happening with the Oates family, is that they got these bad injuries over time from something, or maybe it was something else, but they attested to it being that spaceship crash. And then when Pat Uskert went down there and for the 2008 UFO Hunters episode on the History Channel, it apparently was empty. And so I don't think there's anything now, but fast forward, you know, into much more recent times. We've gone out there on a number of occasions. I was just there on the anniversary earlier this year in April, the 125th anniversary. And I brought out an EMF reader, a Geiger counter, and a metal detector. And I went over both the well and the grave site. And I wasn't getting any EMF readings over the well. There's already metal there on the well, so that's kind of redundant to try to do the metal detecting on that. Yeah. But I went over the grave a number of times, and while people leave trinkets, they leave all kinds of little tokens, coins, things like that. There are little pieces of and bits of metal already there from people leaving stuff. I was getting pings on the metal detector over the grave site, 8 to 10 inches down, that pinged for aluminum and zinc. And so those are the main alloys that were determined from the investigation that was done in the 70s that was sent off to the University of North Texas, that they found out that the highest form of concentration that they could determine that the metal consisted of was aluminum, which they found odd because aluminum would not have been widely available at the time.
Yeah.
It was available. It just wasn't as accessible maybe as obviously it is today. So there are some interesting things about that metal.
Well, and even in the article itself, the ship was too badly wrecked to form any conclusion as to its construction or motive power, but it was built of an unknown metal resembling somewhat a mixture of aluminum and silver and must have weighed several tons. So even right there in 1897, once again, yes, aluminum existed, but it was not in huge mass production the way that it is now.
I think so. And that's one of the really interesting issues, is that maybe it adds credence to the story. But then again, and digging into this further and going up to the Wise County Heritage Museum to investigate their files and what they have stored away through very old documents, there's an interesting book called Across the Zodiac, which might have served as inspiration for this S.E. Hayden, who wrote the article, because it was considered by people who see this as basically being a hoax to drive in tourism to a dying town, that maybe someone came across this story called Across the Zodiac, which also tells about an explosion with some type of otherworldly crash that seemed to have high concentrations of aluminum specifically. So it makes you wonder if this story was around and someone had it in their hand in Aurora, Texas in 1897 or even years prior leading up to it, that maybe it could have been something that was served as inspiration to concoct this interesting but underwhelming story at the time, because a lot of the histories of Wise County, there's a pioneer history of Wise County by Cliff Gates and a few other old histories that don't include this story at all, which to me seems like if it was such a big deal, it probably would have been included. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know exactly if it was something that some people might suggest as they were trying to cover it up. And it was the first government cover up, as I've heard people tell me before. And I think that's interesting, but I'm not really sure that that's the case. However, it is interesting to note that there are other cases very similar. There's one in Cape Girardeau, which another instance of allegedly a crash with a being that was sort of given a religious consideration, you know, in a way that would happen decades afterward, this case. And so there are many interesting aspects to how this story, I think, has been embedded in different ways in the media. I think there's interesting aspects to the metal. It's not impossible for someone to have had aluminum. It's not impossible for someone to have been inspired by other science fiction at the time.
Sure.
Or what would have been the beginnings of science fiction. But I think it's also important to notice the effect that it has, the outlook that we have in ufology as anyone who's trying to find crash debris, who's trying to find alien life forms or the remains thereof, trying to find some type of cohesive form of language or writing, and trying to find some way that it's been part of our history before. I mean, this story, this legend, as I like to refer to it, has all of these ingredients that modern ufologists are looking for today. So one of the issues I come across is people always ask, if I believe that it happened or not. And I think that it's something I have to stay very objective on and somewhat neutral on, because I'm providing historical facts and documentation and trying to not put my own personal outlook in there so much, because I like the story. It's really fun to consider that something like this might have happened, although maybe it's tragic, but I find that it's just as likely that the whole thing could have just been easily hoaxed, because at the time they were suffering over about a decade of near extinction, because the railroad that had just come through from Denver to Fort Worth bypassed the town. And even though Aurora was in Wise County, the only place at the time with a post office, they had a bad spotted fever and many people died. And so while at one point it was the busiest, most happening place in Wise County, it soon died out and it was a ghost town of sorts. And so unfortunately, some people, you know, might have tried to make stories to drive tourism back and get industry back in the town. And that makes sense to some effect, but I think that it's really weird to see how maybe it was a story about a spaceship and a pilot that could have been a Martian used, and why not something a little bit more practical, you know?
Well, and that's just it, you know, why not have a claim to a famous person as was done regularly for tourism back in the day, you know, like John Henry slept here, something like that. But I don't think that stories of little green men and like, I don't think anything like that. I mean, the work of Percival Lowell and stuff like that had just been done, you know? So I don't think that it was necessarily done, as you're saying, for a boon to the town, you know? We hadn't even hit the true arc of spiritualism yet in America. There was some of that, but yeah, it's strange. I don't see, like you're saying, the purpose in trying to fake the story.
Right. It's one of those challenges that it didn't help them out at all. And yeah. You would have thought all this time later that it's such probably, I think, the most popular airship story. I mean, there are some other interesting airship stories as part of the great airship mystery of the 1800s, but
yeah.
I think this one takes the cake. It's probably got to be the most well-known out of any of them at this point, because it's the most sensationalized, whether it was real or not. It's talking about a story of this UFO that crashed that had an alien body. A lot of the other airship stories are interesting, but also very mundane. While they had some exotic ideas, it didn't seem to be much more for many of them than just seeing some strange thing in the sky and maybe hearing some weird sounds and some weird mechanical things, which is, that is all very interesting. And I've done a deep dive through that, through the Airship Mystery, and I do cover quite a bit of that. But the central focus of the work, in this chronology deals specifically with the Aurora story, how the original story had been embedded in all sorts of media, newspaper outlets, and the investigations done throughout those years and even until today. So you mentioned that there's a reward. Up in recent years, I approached the city with Jim Mars back in 2015. And at the time, the city administration, was in favor of holding a commemorative event to, recognize the history of this legend. And so we held the following year, the first ever and probably only ever, what they called the Aurora Alien Encounter. It was a really cool conference where we had a number of people come out, including, not just myself and Jim Mars, but we had Nick Redfern, Noy Torres, Steven Androsko, Tui Snyder, and Travis Walton.
Oh, wow.
And it was a pretty cool event that had a huge turnout. It was sold out. Around 400 people got to come out because that was as many people as you could fit in the building. And we had tours to the crash site, into the cemetery, the grave site. And, it was really great, but we were not able to have another the following year. So I held tours on the subsequent years to the site. And they actually, they did have, however, a haunted, an alien haunt, which was kind of neat because that was a short lived function they did later that year for the Halloween, season. So that's cool. But the city after that, and I guess due to the success and the acknowledgement of the city, in some official capacity and the recognition that it got from a lot of people attending, it garnered enough interest for them to, erect an official monument with a new stylized city logo, which is actually still there. And that's actually one of the cool things you can go to and see now. There is, however, and I'll touch back a little bit of backtracking here. So, you know, a lot of people know Roswell, you know, you say Roswell, it's like a household name. A lot of people don't know all the details in the history, but they kind of relate it to aliens and UFO crashes and sometimes, confuse it with like Area 51 and stuff. But we know Roswell has something to do with aliens and UFOs. But one of the interesting things is that apparently Roswell, whatever happened, if there was a crash or whatever was going on, it's apparent that something was taken. And some people think that while a lot of the material from some kind of crash in Roswell was taken up to Wright-Patterson, in Dayton, Ohio, something seemed to also be taken to Carswell Air Force, or not Air Force, Army Airfield. It was before the Air Force. So, here in Fort Worth, Texas, which is just 20 minutes away from this Aurora crash. So there's an interesting connection with the probably most well-known UFO involvement, UFO crash with Roswell in Fort Worth in this area that happened 50 years later. And I kind of jokingly say that they tried to come back and it was just half a century too late and a state over in the wrong direction. And so, you know, it's just, it's incredible to think about the history that this story has surrounding it, because even years later, after that original investigation in the 70s, a historical marker, an official Texas Historical Commission marker was put out that details that this site is also well known because of the legend, a legend that of the spaceship crashing and the pilot was buried in the local cemetery. So that's on the historical marker, which you can go see. And now there's an official city monument, which is pretty cool. And even in the last few years, there's been a lot of recent developments that have kind of been really wild. They got enough, you know, funding together, it seemed, to put together this big party patio. And they revived this attempt in the early 2000s to have a little bit of a novelty shop that they first called Area 114 because it's off of Highway 114. So they're kind of playing into that whole Area 51 thing where they just had mugs and hats and little, you know, novelty items. And so that didn't last for very long, but they named this party patio Area 114, and they had Martian margaritas, smoking windmill barbecue, and a number of other businesses that sort of played into that theme. You know, cosmic snow cones and atomic cafe. And so a lot of this really cool theme of the whole, like, you know, space and science and aliens type of thing going on. They made their own alien ale, brew. That was also very short-lived. But this is where I think the unfortunate side of things that potentially overshadows the curiosity and the uniqueness of this story was some real activity that I think, you know, is I'm very reluctant to report on, but I feel like it's important to include because it does affect the history of the city as well as this story.
Absolutely.
Which is that, you know, essentially, the city administrator who I worked with Jim Mars to, you know, help put this event together that we held back in 2016 and subsequently the following year, she was on board. And I should mention that, they had a little mascot that was a little alien dummy that, Dr. Tony Wheeler, the former city admin, let me take around and sort of parade around and take on tour to many different events. And everywhere I took him, he had his Aurora shirt on, and I got him buttons and patches for everywhere we went. We went to Roswell, we went to Area 51, we went everywhere. And so it was really cool. And, I got him a wheelchair and wheeled him around because he had been in a bad wreck, you know, and so that was always a fun point of conversation for people. And it was a big thing people wanted to get photos on. That was cool. So I would say that I really did appreciate that, Dr. Tony Wheeler, was really awesome in that respect that she let me do that. She, helped to, you know, provide him and was cool with me taking him around and helping to get the theme of the UFO and alien topic, like, you know, with Aurora made aware with the town.
Yeah.
What's not cool is that apparently she has been, you know, indicted, and committed for like really big criminal charges as of the last year. And I, again, I'm very reluctant to say all of that, but I feel like it's important to not overlook that and to just kind of sweep it under the rug.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that little alien dummy, which he was called Ned, because when Tony was a little girl growing up in Aurora, the old timer who told her about the story was named Ned. So there's kind of that sentiment to how, you know, the alien's name is Ned. And unfortunately, I think he was within City Hall here up until like when I brought him back. And unfortunately, Tony, for a number of years, had been somehow getting some kind of money into accounts and using it secretly, unbeknownst to the rest of the city council and the townsfolk of Aurora. And it turned out that she had stolen a large sum of money,
$656,909 to be exact.
Yeah. And even more than that from the recent reports, unfortunately, it could be closer to about $1 million. And it's very unfortunate. And I think that it's too bad because the theme of the UFO and alien story, the legend that she was up for, helping out with, that's cool. Stealing your town's money is not cool. I think it really upset a lot of people. And a lot of people I've talked to there, they said, you know, Tony's our friend. But it's a really difficult issue. So unfortunately, and I don't know for sure, and I don't want to speculate because I respect Tony for what we got to do together. It's hard to think about what to make sense of with this whole thing with everything now, but it seems to be very indicative that after things seem to be very apparent or more obvious to those who were finding that the numbers weren't adding up, there was suddenly a mysterious fire at City Hall and it burned down. And so unfortunately, it seems like that little alien guy, Ned, was in City Hall when it burned down. So unfortunately, now I think maybe he's been in two tragedies.
Oh, man.
So the City Hall has been burned down. I just say I don't know for sure. It just seems very suspicious that there was a fire that coincided with this audit and that there's no trace of the records. You know, and I don't know, and I don't want to throw Tony under the bus because I appreciate what she helped to offer for the in regard to the legend, right? But again, this is real criminal activity. And so here just recently, the city, over the last year, the city has had to kind of pull things together, figure out how to make do and meet at another location because they have no city hall, which again was just the size of about a house. but now we're coming up on the anniversary of the city. Actually, we just passed it, and they decided they made some new announcements. And so the long-running newspaper there of the county, the Wise County Messenger, which had been going on since well before the legend. So again, over you know, 100 years, over 125, actually, the Wise County Messenger just shared a few weeks ago that because of their anniversary, they're announcing that they have a new city council plan. They have a new plan to erect a new city hall. So this is, again, getting up on a high note. I'm glad to see this is happening. Great. The unfortunate part of this is that Area 114, the party patio, has been acquired by the county. And from what I understand, it's being auctioned off. Now, I don't know if that's happening actively, if it's being on hold, or if it's if they're waiting for the legalities to be straightened out. But here's the thing is someone could acquire it and get it back up and running, or someone could say, I'm buying this and I'm doing away with all of it and we're doing something else. So, you know, I think it's up to us. I think as a community of people interested in this, we have to see what is possible by staying up to date with it. And that's what I've been trying to do is, again, chronicle everything I can about this legend, this story, this town, in a way that helps to showcase that the history doesn't just affect the people who are interested in aliens and UFOs, but this is a real place, a real town with real people. And, you know, It's fun to think that their logo and their slogan was a legendary Western town. And I think that's a classic. And I think that it's important to keep that spirit alive, to keep the legend alive.
Yeah.
In some way, whether you think it's real or you think it's a hoax or whatever, it helps to add, I think, to the history, to the lore of what we're all interested in.
Well, and it's tough, especially whenever you are. It's one thing to investigate something that is ongoing. It's one thing to investigate something that's not too far history, or even once again, well documented history. There were a few reports. Once again, that page had 9 different reports on it. One of them I found interesting. In the headline, it talked about sightings from Stephenville. So, not the first time that there has been action over the skies of Stephenville, Texas, apparently.
That's right. And just because you had mentioned that, you know, and that is really interesting as well, because there are a lot of little places in Texas that are mentioned in this and many of these airship articles, right?
Yeah.
But as you just said, Stephenville had one of the largest and more recent sightings. Now it's been a few years, but
yep.
Stephenville had their flap, as we call them in ufology. Anytime a huge sighting happens, sometimes people say that it's a UFO flap. In 2008, the guy I mentioned earlier, Ken Cherry, who I worked with for a number of years, he, as the state director for MUFON here in Texas, with that other guy I mentioned, Steve Hudgens, they both went out and launched the investigation into the Stephenville UFO, and it made national news. They were all over. They held a press conference, and that's really important. And I'll mention why is also in relation to the story is that they're responsible also for helping to get Aurora back out, and they're the ones who helped to get the History Channel on board to investigate Aurora. So this all connects. It's very interesting to me. You mentioned earlier the reward for the headstone. When we did some tours, when I held a tour back in 2018, we had Stratton Horace, who's a lawyer in Dallas, come out and offer a reward for the whereabouts of the original headstone, if not the actual stone itself. And he upped the ante. He says, you know, originally it was like $1,000, and I think it turned up to $2,000. Now it was like $2,500. I think it might be even more now if it still even is out there.
Wow.
And so that's really interesting to consider that. If it ever happened that this, you know, there's a reward for it, even now, or even up until recent times. So the more recent things to me are, you know, all the different shows, like what we're doing right now,
yep.
All the YouTube specials, the podcast specials, the network, you know, television specials, the things on any of these different documentaries that talk about this. So, you know, I think it's very interesting because there's something to how this has affected the study of UFOs. And I think how with the original story talking about all of those interesting things, it's exactly what modern ufologists are looking for. And if not anything else, it should serve as inspiration for what, you know, we can learn from. And that's why I really am interested in this alongside just living nearby and having gone a number of occasions. I'm really honored that my good friend, the late Jim Mars, first introduced me to the site.
Yeah,
both the crash site and the grave site, and it's something that I'm glad to continue on, you know, the legacy and the spirit of keeping the legend alive, you know, I think it's important to see that, you know, I'm just doing what I can to keep this out there. And so it's one of the things that I'm glad to be doing through this publication, which is going to, again, chronicle all these different things, and including what we're doing here today about this story. I'm going to be including this and all the times that we've brought it up in yeah. other engagements as well.
Well, and, you know, before we get into the upcoming show that you are going to be a part of here at the Wonderland Festival this upcoming weekend, there's one more question that I had regarding this article. Has anybody ever found the notebook? It makes mention of the fact that papers found on his person, evidently the records of his travel, are written in some unknown hieroglyphics and cannot be deciphered. It's the only mention of the papers that were with the body. Has anything like that ever been found or alluded to, or has anybody ever been able to track that down?
You know, I've heard things here and there. I did have one lead, and I'll just mention this briefly, is that this person I talked to, I had known a little bit prior to our involvement with Aurora, and it had nothing to do with Aurora. And I told them about something I was doing and this area, and they immediately said, oh, that's the one with the alien in the grave. That's that story. And they immediately knew what it was without me having to provoke any ideas or lead them into any line of thinking. They already knew what it was. And they said, yeah, I was there X number of years ago, and I was shown bits of metal with strange writing, like strange symbols on it. So I had one person tell me about that. I don't know if it really happened, because we tried to follow it up and nothing really came of it. But I think it's really interesting because it adds another layer to the story. So I depicted this in some artwork. I made a very dramatic depiction that's going to be the cover of this book, that shows the crash, the windmill, the well, the water tower, and the body parts of the pilot. Which I depict as a little green man, you know, because I think it's fitting for the sort of the time frame, you know.
Absolutely.
And I have, as you can see in the artwork, in his hand, he's holding some of that paper, you know, that has some strange little writings that's very hard to make out. But that's the idea, is that maybe it's in that coffin. Maybe it's in some little casket with a little body or body parts, you know. Mm.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why no one's come up with it. I mean, and the other thing is if anyone saw it, and even if it was real and it was out there, would they even know what they're looking at? Or would they think, let's toss it, let's burn it, throw it in the burn pile, you know? And so there's any number of things that we can wonder about with it. But I'd like to say, hey, if it's out there, maybe it's in that grave. Maybe it is stored away. And if it was some type of, you know, just to make light of it, maybe if it was some type of alien writing on alien material, maybe it can stand the test of time and not degrade and decompose. And maybe it's just preserved and, just waiting to be exhumed legally, hopefully at some point in the near future. I don't know, but
well,
would tell us, you know.
And you never know. We may have a Dragon Man moment, you know, the same way that the Dragon Man skull was found in China, where somebody's grandfather was on their deathbed and said, hey, you may want to check at the bottom of the well, because there's this thing that I put down there that I never wanted to tell anybody that I found. And we see that more and more these days, these deathbed confessions from people who are witnesses, people who have evidence, that kind of stuff. So to see somebody who maybe has some wreckage or documentation, anything like that, come along with the deathbed confession, I would not be surprised.
Well, we know that anyone who was alive back then is no longer alive now, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But we do know that Jim Mars and others had talked to witnesses at the time. And again, it was still even very divided. Some people say that it was all just made up. Some people say, yeah, I remember it. I saw it. I was there. I remember hearing the crash. My parents went and looked at it the next day, and these sort of things. And so I think that I don't want to be excluding any of those things that because it's nice to think that because it happened to neglect the fact that people definitely said it didn't. Because it's easy to build a compelling case when all you are favoring and just the stories that make it sound good. So I want to make sure that people can see that, yes, people say it happened. Yes, people say it didn't happen. And not one way or the other, because I think that's where all the sources of information that people talk about really come from a few people. And the main detractors of it say that this person was alive and they say it didn't happen, so therefore it didn't. But it's okay, well, the other person was alive and they say it did. So depends on who you ask. And I think that the interesting thing is that there was some type of explosion or something that seems to have happened, because there was molten metal and alloys embedded within the rocks and the trees, and some of the rocks had strange scorch marks. And again, it's not impossible that something like this happened after the fact, but you know, just to think that there are these traces of some kind of high temperature, high heat based activity in the area. If you look at Google Maps or some type of aerial view, it looks like the ground is scorched. There's no vegetation in that area. I mean, it's growing back now, but it's like, It's a really strange star on the Earth. And, you know, maybe that there was something that happened that affected the terrain. And I'm curious that, you know, there could still be, I mean, it would be great to think that things can turn up, like you're saying, that deathbed confessions or like, you know, people keeping things intact, being henned down, heirlooms and whatnot. I mean, that would be so surprising, I think, for everybody to find out, oh yeah, this bit of the metal actually has been held in my family, or it turned up in an estate sale or something. And, you know, it turns out the whole thing's actually real and it all happened. Or here's a picture. But I will say this. I want to just mention that I think it's important. There is a picture of S.E. Hayden that does exist, which shows him sort of on a wagon. And there's a picture of his homestead, which shows a windmill, which shows a water tower. And while it wasn't his house, I think that it's supposed that this happened, it was it was Judge Proctor, right? And so it's interesting to think that, you know, maybe this guy Hayden liked the idea of the story involving sort of his familiar environment, his home, I guess you could say, because of this picture where he's got. And I was holding the original picture. It was taken in, I think, 65 or 67 by Etta Pegues, who wrote the story, Aurora, the town that might have been. And so there is a book out there. It's hard to find. And it's something that kind of just tells about the history of the town. And unfortunately, you know, it takes a look at the story as being, you know, more of a hoax than anything. But just that, because it gets a lot of attention, it has to be included in a history of Aurora. And there was a picture of S.E. Hayden's home, which had a windmill, which had a water tower. And, you know, it's not there anymore. But the back of the picture tells about how this is the guy who wrote that article, you know. And so it's really interesting that maybe he was inspired by where he lived to come up with the idea that this thing crashed into a windmill and the water tower and was thrown into a well. So, you know, even though that there are good reasons to see why there's some fun inspiration for this being a story, I think there are also strange curiosities to wonder how maybe it could have also been very real. And I know that might be a stretch for some people to say, you know, get real. You know, it was obviously a hoax. They were trying to draw in tourism to a dying town. Yes, it all makes sense, but consider the alternative. What if it all was real? What if we did find something, like you're saying, the smoking gun years later that says, you know what? It did all happen. That would be, I think, you know, headlines of the century, perhaps. And I think that's a really exciting notion.
Once again, and this is just where I come from it as a point of logic when it comes to if it was made up to bring tourism to a town. There were not that many towns that, quote, made their money off tourism in 1897. You know? there were major thoroughfares, stuff like that, but... and sure, they may have gotten skipped over by the railroad because of pox or what have you, but I cannot see that as the purpose behind this, You know, once again, it's not like it was the 1950s and UFOs were all the talk and the rage, you know.
It would have been much different. It would have been part of the flying saucer craze of the 50s and 60s. And yeah. It would have been the buzz, you know, all of that sort of stuff. You're right.
Yeah. So in 1897, it's one of those, I think people were way too busy actively living. You know, much like whenever you hear about the devil circles from the 1500s being reported. And yeah, they were crop circles, man. You know what people weren't busy doing during the time of the Black Plague? Just hoaxing crop circles and destroying half a town's wheat field, you know? That wasn't what people were doing, you know? They didn't really have the disposable time. They were literally busy living. I don't know. I fall down on the fact of it may very well have happened the way it says it happened, at least in some way, shape, or form. Once again, the people that occupied the property later complained of possible ill effects from stuff. It would be interesting to go back and revisit some of this. So I cannot wait for the release of your book. Let everybody know, because you're actively out this weekend at the Wonderland UFO Fest. Let everybody know where they can go to check that out and any other upcoming appearances you have. I know you have another one coming up after that as well.
Yeah, you know, this is a really busy time getting into fall here pretty soon. There's so much going on that I try to share about it on my social media pages, which I'm pretty easy to get a hold of that way. And on the Vortex, I'm going to, more than likely, if I get a good signal out there, I'm going to see if I can live stream the Wonderlands UFO Festival. And that's in San Antonio, as you said earlier, at the Wonderlands of America mall out there. And it's kind of like a convention. So there's going to be some fun stuff going on, vendors, people in costumes, and I'm going to have a little, you know, fun for the first time. I'm throwing this together. It's kind of a fun project that I've been working on a little bit here recently. But, you know, I mentioned how I used to take around that little alien mascot, Ned. Well, I don't think he's going to be making the rounds anymore. So I kind of went out and got my own as a little mock-up. And unfortunately, this guy is a little bit different. What was fun about Ned is he had a wheelchair. He was like just a standalone alien. So I could put him in a wheelchair. This other one, he's going to be paraded around in a little coffin, just like it might have been 125 years ago. So that's going to be fun. I'm going to have those, you know, the crunched up little pieces of metal, maybe some of that burnt up alien writings, you know, and give you a good sense and feel. Like, if you want to come check that out, come get a picture with what would have looked like, you know, this spaceman of Aurora, you know, I think that would be fun. So check out the Vortex on YouTube. I'm going to try to live stream it. That's going to be this weekend, this Saturday. In San Antonio, there's a Facebook page for it as well. You can search Wonderland UFO Festival. And then I'm going to be doing a really interesting sort of UFO / paranormal event at the Haunted Hill House in Mineral Wells. This is that Hill House that's been seen on a lot of these different paranormal shows. We're going to do for the first time ever a UFO themed event with a Sky Watch that I'm a part of and I'm putting together. So that's going to be fun. You can also see me at the upcoming Texas Bigfoot Conference in Jefferson, Texas, also one of the haunted places, you know, in the Bigfoot capital of Texas. And then I just will also give a shout out that we're going to have the Texas UFO Conference.
I can't wait.
In November, the first one. And that's going to be where I think I'm going to debut my book and have it all ready for that. So it should be a lot of fun stuff coming up. I will be going to the Mothman Festival next month, and speaking or anything. I'm just going to go check it out. I've never been, but I'm going to go see what Mothman's up to these days. You know, go find a lamp that he might be hanging out next to and, you know, just see what that's like.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I guess my next stop is the IANS conference. I'm going to the International Association of Near-Death Studies conference. Is a sponsor coming up here in a week. So get ready for some of that content, folks. We'll be talking to folks about studies into near-death studies. So, yeah, pretty wild. Apparently, the Bigelow Institute puts this on. So
Very cool.
Yeah. Should be really interesting. It's going to be super fun. Daniel, thank you so much, as always, for coming on, sharing your wealth of knowledge about topics and stories like these, especially here in our Lone Star State. I cannot wait for your book to come out. Can't wait to see you this weekend at the Wonderland Festival. I will be out there just casually to support you and see your presentation, things like that. So thank you, as always, for coming on and taking the time, bud.
My pleasure, Chris. It's always an honor. I really appreciate the opportunity to come out, and, you know, we have great discussions, and I really like that you get to get all these wonderful topics and guests on your show and spread the good news about all of this stuff. I'm glad to hear you're going to be at the IANS conference. That's so cool. I'll have to make it out to that one. Another interesting subject, but thank you so much, Chris. And, you know, we'll see you then.
Absolutely, man. Take care, bud. While you are online checking out everything from Daniel Allen Jones, of course, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is the website. Hold on through this commercial break, folks. We will be talking in our pre-recorded segment with Todd Cochran. Todd Cochran is the owner of Blueberry. Some of you may know them as one of the largest podcast hosting companies out there. We're going to be having a conversation about privacy in the world of podcasting in this medium right here. What data are you giving away whenever you are visiting random sites and listening to people's content or downloading apps? And it's kind of disturbing sometimes what's out there. So stay tuned through these commercials, from our great sponsors, and we will get into that conversation with Todd Cochran, who is currently here in the great Lone Star State at, Podcast Movement in Dallas. So he has some exciting product releases that he'll be talking about in the latter part of the episode. Until next time, we'll see you right after this break, folks. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. And welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much to our sponsors, as always. WebWorks Wireless. WebWorksWireless.com is your home for unlimited, no data caps, no throttling, no credit check wireless internet. I have been using them for Curious Realm since the beginning of the show. They have been the source of all of our website live streams from on location, everything else. I'm here to tell you folks about 20 gigs of data a month I live stream through this platform, and absolutely amazing. Stop on by, check them out. WebWorksWireless.com is the website. Also, make sure to stop on by The Secret to Everything. Secret to Everything is the website of our good friend, guest, and sponsor, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge. She is your number one source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness expansion exercises. SecretToEverything.com is the website. And of course, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is the website. That's where you can find all of our content. That's where you can find all of our episodes. That's also where you can find our new Share Your Story link. If you are an experiencer, if you're a targeted individual, if you have had a UFO sighting, abduction, if you have seen Bigfoot, a cryptid, anything like that, stop on by CuriousRealm.com/story. Share your stories and pictures with us, and we will use them in upcoming episodes and actually pose these cases to professionals, investigators, things like that. Speaking of professionals, our guest in this segment, I'm very happy to welcome back to the podcast. He is the CEO of Blueberry.com. Blueberry is one of the largest podcasting platforms out there. They are the makers of the Blueberry PowerPress plugin that we actually use on the Curious Realm website. Welcome back to the show, Todd Cochran. How are you doing?
I am doing good. It's been a little while, but thanks for having me on.
Oh, man, I am always glad to have someone of your ilk and status in an industry on. Honestly, because you really do over at Blueberry head up a huge point of the spear when it comes to podcasting and this kind of content. You and I have had numerous private discussions about what we're going to be discussing, which is privacy and podcasting. So many people are out there. As of COVID, as of the beginning of the pandemic, there were close to 1 million podcasts out there. More than that now. And with the rage that podcasts are, even with people listening to podcasts, I don't think they realize the data that is being scraped by some of these services. And that's what I wanted to have you on about.
Yeah, it's great by some, not by all.
Not by all. By reputable good services, things like that, things like Blueberry, that kind of stuff. Absolutely not. But there are definitely some out there that definitely grab a lot of data and are grabbing a lot of cookies and things like that.
I think if you look at it from a perspective of when you sign up for a service, you really are agreeing to a term. You know, they've got, you know, 800 page terms of service. No one reads them, but you're probably at that point making a determination that you are giving up some information. You know, you go on Amazon. Obviously, you've signed up for Amazon, and you know they're marketing towards you, and you see that when you're searching the web.
Oh, absolutely.
You maybe search for a product and go back to Amazon. Maybe it, you know, shows up. So there's, you know, there are certain things that we kind of know. You know, if you're on Gmail or, you know, you've given up some stuff through the terms of service. But when you subscribe to a podcast or follow a podcast, there's no terms of service. It's just, you know, it's either in an app, and usually those apps have app terms, but that really doesn't trickle down to where that media is, because even if you maybe listen to a show on Apple Podcast or Fountain or Overcast, those podcasts are really served across a wide variety of places. And each of those services collect a little bit of different information. Now, we took the approach at Blueberry that privacy of listeners was really, really important for multiple reasons. And even though a lot of people don't like the GDPR that was established in the European Union, we basically established GDPR standards and CCPA, California privacy standards across the board. And basically anyone that listens to a show that is hosted at Blueberry, really their data is protected in a big way as far as that IP data, which is personal identifiable these days. I've sat in offices in New York and shown a demo of, someone asked me what's the IP of my home computer, and I've given it to them, and they pulled up remarkable amount of information.
Oh, God, yes. God, yes, man. Like data histories, all kinds of things. Like you
right.
can, you, and I do a lot of work on the road for SAP, and SAP writes a lot of algorithm. And I've always found it interesting that while I'm doing night shift, and my show is all pre-record, my wife is pushing it out from the studio here, and I'll be quality controlling, just listening to it on, you know, one of my monetized platforms, whatever. But I've always loved the fact that the advertising that gets pushed out on that monetized platform is always SAP. and it's like, wow, man, for them to literally write the algorithm to track my location,
right,
and
right.
feed that commercial into that platform because I'm at an SAP event.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty and, impressive.
You
it's
know,
pretty
and there's,
impressive.
There's other things that are happening now, and you know, Spotify, they made an acquisition of two very big companies that do a lot of this tracking. And attribution. They basically will measure a listener that's come in to listen to an episode on a particular show, and you won't know whether that podcaster is using, as a listener, you won't know if that service is using Chartable or Podsites, the two companies that Spotify bought. You have no idea. And let's say you hear an ad for, you know, company ABC. And then maybe that same day or the next day, you go over to abc.com or whatever website you're actually been referred to, And they'll actually match that up. They'll say, hey, this listener listened to this episode with this ad, and then they showed up over here on this vendor's website. So they do an attribution tracking to put two and two together. Now, while that's in itself is not necessarily a concern, it becomes a concern when that data is used, number one, to be, and again, we don't know if this is happening, but, you know, data, Spotify did not buy these two companies because they were these big earning revenue generators. They bought it. They bought these companies for the data and the listener data. So this ability then to say, okay, listener listened to the ad, he went to the vendor. Now, how do we target them when they come to Spotify or on other shows or on that platform? So it really becomes a point now where there's no more true privacy, and there's not a lot listeners can do about it because, again, the podcast host, aka the creator, me as a creator, not the hosting provider. And we've got shows at Blueberry where our podcasters, the people that use our service, add one of those chartable or one of those pod sites prepends to that media URL. And while we anonymize the data, they don't. Right. And they take that information. So, and what they do with it, then you have to, you know, you have to take that with the podcaster. But I think from my perspective, for content creators, I think we have to choose wisely who we expose our audiences to.
Absolutely. I mean, even when it came to building my app for the podcast, I don't even have it up on a service. You go and you click a picture on our app page and it sideloads onto your device.
Right.
You don't even have to go give your data to the Google Play Store to have our app.
You know, I think the thing you have to think about too is the, you know, it's one of those things, this is a scenario, and the best way I'd like to describe it is one of one that you would be concerned of. Let's say you have a teenager who is at a point in his life, or she is at a point in his life where they're maturing and they're trying to figure out their sexual orientation, and maybe they're having leanings towards the LGBTQ. And they start subscribing to a number of LGBTQ plus shows. And maybe they're doing this privately in a way that, where they're just, you know, they're trying to figure out their sexuality. And what happens then if someone is monitoring those IPs that are coming in? And the next thing you know, the young adult is potentially having something marketed to them in the mail, or something pops up on mom and dad's. So all of a sudden you're in a situation where maybe someone that is not out yet is going to become under pressure. So I think the key here is, and then that's an extreme example. But again, it's one of those where if you want to be an incognito window on a browser and go look at different things, it gives you a little bit level of privacy. And there's also Tor browser and a variety of other browsers you can use if you really want to stay incognito or use a VPN. But it's not the case when you're using your mobile phone and you're connecting to some content that you're listening to that may end up embarrassing you or coming back to you in a way that maybe you don't want anyone to know about yet. So again, sure. it's just an example.
There was a story probably about 8-10 years ago now about a young lady who was 17 years old, grew up in a very staunchly religious household, had a friend who was the same age who became pregnant. She went to Babies R Us, bought something off her registry, gave her their email address, and, you know, like, hey, here's my stuff. Like, yeah, you know, we'll give you deals, whatever. Well, mom starts receiving things in the mail at the house with her daughter's name on it from Babies R Us. This girl was literally like kicked out of her home by her parents, disowned by her religious right family, everything. So like these cases are real. It's not something that just Like, it's an ethereal thing. Like,
right,
that
right.
was some data that somebody put on an innocuous thing that literally ruined their life.
So I think, you know, and that may be an extreme example, but sure. I've always said that podcasting is, number one, the last bastion of free speech.
True.
And number two, if you are a host and you care about your listeners' privacy, you should be very forthright in what's happening when they listen to this show. You know, what, yeah. how, as an example, we just introduced programmatic advertising at Blueberry.
Yep.
And the first question I was asked on social was, what are you doing? How are you targeting? And really, it boils down to two things. We do look at the IP for the geolocation. Mm-hmm. So I know what region you're in. So if I'll know you're in Dallas, or I'll know you're in Houston, or I'll know you're in LA or Boise. I'll know you the region.
Sure.
And I'll know probably the device you're using, but that's it. We don't do any IP tracking farther than that. And then what happens is once we've really geolocated you and served an ad that might be geo-specific, then once the data is and we process the stats and the information we pull from the stats is, were you on an Apple device? Again, what was your geography?
Yep.
And a few other things that are non-identifiable. And then we randomize the IP address in our logs, and they go into our cold storage. And if someone was to hack us and get a hold of those log files, they would not be able to determine the
actual source of that
right,
IP.
Any IP data anymore, because it's random pseudomized. So it's that's what we've really built our platform on privacy. So when we're introducing the programmatic advertising, that was a question I had. And then I was like, does this data get resold? No. You know, so we came up with a data agreement on how this data was going to be handled with our partner, with SoundStack.
Hugely responsible and forward thinking of you over there to do that, because so many people do not. I'll admit the fact, if you're listening on, I had somebody that was like, there are so many commercials on Spotify. I'm like, go to my website. You'll hear my baked in commercials from sponsors. Whatever's on a monetized website, I can't control how often they interrupt my show
and throw in a commercial. And I think as a podcaster, you have the responsibility to tell your listener, you know, what you're doing with their data.
Yeah.
And, we're pretty heavy on this privacy kick. Attribution is not bad so long as it's done in a responsible way. And my idea of attribution would be, okay, let's say Blueberry introduces an attribution product to compete with Chartable and Podsites. The attribution model is you get a report that says, on August 18th, you had 22 listeners that heard the ad that ended up on your website. Mm-hmm. And that's it. We're not going to give you any IP data. We're not going to give you data that you can use to remarket to them. Because these big companies, that's exactly what they want to do. They want to hit you once and then say, okay, I know who you are. You've reacted to my product. Now I got you.
Yeah.
So now let me remarket to you 82 times. But here's the challenge too. If a company is looking at that attribution data, there's nothing I can do once you have landed on that vendor's webpage. They've got the data that they want themselves. So they then, on their own, can start retargeting you as they normally would. But the attribution piece is really just a report. So it's one of those things where it's kind of like, okay, I'm not going to tell you the IPs, but they've already got the IPs. But they don't know which specific IPs. Right. So they'll know they had 800,000 people hit their website over a month, and the 600 you sent over there for the podcast ad, they're not going to know. They're not going to be able to do that. So you're going to be in that pool of 800,000, but you're not going to be in that pool of 600 that specifically was targeted for a specific product.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, when it comes to a platform, when it comes to, especially as a podcaster, how to control that. Number one, website, own your URL.
Absolutely.
Feed it from there primarily.
Yeah, own your feed. Yeah.
Yeah. Free is what you get with it.
Sure.
And what it comes with, you know, and there's a lot of caveats with that.
Now, again, I'm not saying, another thing you have to realize, if you're listening to podcasts on Spotify, they already have your user account. They know who you are.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're literally learning anything new about you, but what they are learning about is what you're doing outside of their platform. Now.
That's right. On that device that you're listening on the
right.
computer or IP address that you're
that's
listening
right.
on.
That's right.
And that's just it. That's how the advertising gets pushed to you, everything mm-hmm. else. It's the tracking cookies, all that kind of stuff on your
yep.
on your phone, your devices, your accounts. And I'm one of those, even with the recent issues going on here in Austin with the defamation lawsuit with Alex Jones, it was another one of those prime examples of like, it's why the man has his own website. Because yeah, he was deplatformed from everywhere else,
right?
You know, and yet still, despite that, there was a report showing the other day that he's showing record sales. So it's like, despite everything, still coming from his own website. And I know he doesn't really do any privacy, anything crazy with people's information, things like that. But you really do have to be careful whenever you are going out and just joining a platform.
Yeah.
Do a little bit of research, folks.
And ask that platform, what is your privacy policy, or read in at terms of service what their privacy policy is.
Yeah.
It's really critical. It really, really is to know. And again, I think we are all, I think it's an age dependent thing too. I think people that are younger are more used to saying, well, it just comes to the territory of being on the internet. But it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, the states are now starting to close the gap. I think there's 8 or 9 states that has legislation on the table that's similar to California's legislation they passed a few years ago. So little by little, and maybe even the federal government, maybe, and I don't know if they'll ever really do anything, but at some point, some of this privacy stuff has to be closed. They know enough about us already. How much, for God's sake, how much more do they need?
data. And, you know, it's interesting. Earlier you were bringing up, before you brought up California's policies, the EU's policies. We can thank them for the cookie tracking on websites and the like, do you accept cookies? Because used to be you just got your cookies followed.
At least you know when you're on it. It's part of their law now. At least you have to. You know, I've been on some UK sites where there's a big stack. You know, there's 20 things you're agreeing to.
Yeah.
And they basically, the EU says you can opt out.
Yeah.
And you can use the website.
That's right.
But sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have to accept that to use the website.
Yeah. Sometimes there's a minimum amount of tracking required, things like that.
So at least that you're agreeing to it. And there's in podcasting, there's no opting in.
Well, and that I think is mainly because the EU has an actual legal definition of digital identity.
And let's be frank, it's pretty strict.
It is hugely strict and amazing. And when it was passed, it was one of those like, this is visionary and awesome. And once again, like the metric system, I guess we will be the last adopters.
Well, it's capitalism rules, my friends, the mighty dollar and the lobbyists will go in there and battle. Now, Google has tried. And they've had so much pushback. They pushed their cookie, cancellation back a couple of years, and they just again extended it, I think, out into 23. So, they understand cookies are, they're just, you know, they've been in with browsers really from day one almost. Yeah. So,
yeah. But, and there was actually, a big push here recently by Google workers here it is, Google employees, that was Fox Business from 2021, But there was an article recently talking about how Google employees were pushing Google to stop so much data tracking. Like, please stop tracking everything on everything. You know, like, some tracking, like you're saying, is it's necessary. It's necessary to keep the wheels greased, to keep them moving, to keep revenues flowing, that kind of stuff. But you don't have to track every single click of everything.
Right.
And I think that is where the EU absolutely has it right. Once again, good God, we don't even have a law that says the government can't experiment on the population, much less a law that says that this is what a digital identity is, you know, and to protect us in that way. It's pretty visionary what they did over there, and it would be really, really great to see us adopt that. It would be a solution to a lot of these issues.
Yeah, we'll see what the politicians do. I'm not going to hold my breath, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Me neither. Well, I know that you are having a crazy busy time. Tell us a little bit about your upcoming event, because when this goes out, you will actually be traveling pretty close to here local in the Dallas area going to Podcast Movement. Tell us a little bit about your appearance there.
Yeah.
What
so,
you're going to be doing.
So when will this come out? So
this will be coming out Tuesday.
Okay, perfect. So yeah, we've been in a race up to Podcast Movement to release a whole bunch of new products. It really started with the introduction of the ability to have your own media kit on Blueberry.
Yep.
And it takes a combination of your stats, your listener surveys, and combines that all together and kicks out a beautiful media kit that updates on a regular basis. Then we did a integration with Descript. Descript is a audio editing platform where you can, once you get done editing in Descript, you can automatically ship over your audio file and transcript, and they come right into our platform. We launched an integration with a company called PodRocket, and it's basically an educational resource where all Blueberry hosting customers get Podcast 101 and some advanced courses along with Blueberry training on their platform for free. It's an educational resource.
That's great.
And then obviously this week we launched the programmatic advertising. We'd been talking about that for a while and finally got it finished up. And now it's open for any podcaster to be able to monetize a show from day one of them creating their first episode. And the way I kind of look at that product, it's a bridge product. So it allows a brand new podcaster to get started, start earning some money, to get to build their show, to get some revenue coming in, that ultimately when they get a little bit bigger in an audience size, be able to attract a bigger sponsor. But our biggest thing that we think is an integration, and it's basically we kind of hit the lottery on this one. We integrate with Rev, and Rev is a transcription company. So essentially what is happening is you be able to get a transcript generated automatically from Rev. It's an add-on product. We're going to give it a free trial for people through the 15th of September. Ooh. But the most important thing is when the transcript comes back, it gets dropped, and this is technical, it gets dropped into the Podcast 2.0 transcript tag. And the new audio player that we're introducing actually has closed caption support. So this is the first time in podcasts, the first time ever that a podcasting platform or a podcast listening app on a website has closed captions. So it's huge on accessibility. We've,
huge on Google statistic too. At least it will be eventually.
It will eventually, but the biggest piece here really is it allows content creators who want to have their shows be accessible to be accessible. Mm-hmm. There was really kind of this hodgepodge solution before, people putting a link in their website, and you know, it wasn't a clean. And there's really now SiriusXM today responded to their lawsuit in a really negative way, saying, hey, we don't believe we should have to provide a transcript or closed caption. And
wow.
It was a pretty nasty rebuttal, in my opinion, back to the person that initially set the lawsuit. So Blueberry is being a service provider. My concept was we have to at least make it available to content creators that want to provide closed captions for their shows to their audiences. Now,
yeah,
the automated process is probably 95, 96, 97% accuracy, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's the key. And really this accessible audio player is, I think is a huge achievement for us. Because
That is incredible, incredible leverage of some new technology and really, really forward thinking, Todd. Really forward thinking.
You know, we've been this website and our platform has been accessible from day one. Matter of fact, if we have an accessibility issue, we have a lot of people that are vision impaired that are podcasting, that are using JAWS and other type of screen readers.
Yep.
If we get a customer support ticket that is accessibility issue, it's like an immediate, like that goes to the top of the priority list. All other work stops and this gets fixed first. That was really it has been for, and again, these don't come up very often, but when they do, sure, they're a priority emergency fix. So it had been bothering me for a long, long time. How do we get this accessibility issue fixed for listeners?
Yeah.
So this is really, truly a listener feature. And I think it's going to come as a shock to those that have a hearing impediment. Or hearing impaired. I don't know what there's actually a correct word for it.
You know what's funny though, Todd? There is a huge trend, especially amongst youth, with subtitling. So for you to be incorporating this and for podcasting to be especially so popular in that mid-20s, younger 20s range, like, you're on the cusp of something, man. These kids are used to watching YouTube, stuff like that, more than any other content source. Yep. It's got subtitling capabilities.
That's right.
I was just reading an article the other day about how, like, the subtitling revolution on platforms, like watching Hulu with subtitles on.
Right.
That kind of stuff.
And this is long form content. Yeah. So what happens is in our
stuff
player,
like mine, where it's like, hey, here's 4 hours.
Right. Here's a player and it has a closed caption logo and you click on that and below it opens up a drawer. And then as the content is playing, you can see the yellow. There's a yellow highlight that follows along.
Now, bouncing ball.
Now you can, if you want, scroll quicker. If you read faster than you can listen, you can take it over and scroll ahead. It is possible to do that. The audio piece doesn't slide ahead, just the transcript does. So, but for someone that's hearing impaired, maybe some folks are also at the point where they were wearing a hearing aid.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're using it as a backup.
Yeah.
Now, this is web-based only. It's not in an app. So if you're using one of the popular podcasting apps, it's not supported there. It's just purely on the web-based player. But I think what this is going to do is it's going to give mobile app developers an incentive to add this to their players. Because if we're already providing the SRTV TT file, then the app, all they have to do is read that off the feed and use that in their own system. So it's a 2-for-1 for them.
Yeah.
And at the same time, folks that are integration with the script, since Descript also sends a VRT or SRT or VTT file over, which is, for those of you who don't know, that's the format for closed caption.
Yes.
It's text with bottom metadata.
Yes.
And we'll get that file automatically. We'll pre-populate their transcript tag. So when they hit publish, it's there. So the simple fact that we integrated with the script and we're taking both those files, the audio file and the video and the transcript, and putting that into their post pre-publishing, really, you know, it saves them a step.
Yeah.
You know, so time is money in creating content. So
time's money, period.
And we've got a little secret trick now too for PowerPress users is that when you click publish on your show, yeah. I have no way of ever going back and updating your RSS feed.
Yep.
Without doing anything, without having you to hit republish again. So we're doing a little trickery behind the scenes. I'll just say this. Your transcript file will be linked. And what it will say for about the first 3 to 5 minutes in it is transcript coming soon. Because what we're going to do is we're going to pre-create your link and your media file. And when your transcript comes back from the vendor, comes back from Rev, we'll do a replace and it'll basically be there. So we don't have to go back and re-update your RSS feed.
Yeah, because that is something to consider. I know I've had it before where I've gone through and re-uploaded a file, things like that. And hey, sorry, folks, whatever went out through that RSS, yeah, that probably didn't get re-updated. So you want the corrected file, feel free to hop on over to the website.
Well, it'll automatically update with this transcript. So then the link isn't bad. The link is valid. Instead of the link only having a few words in it, it'll have the full transcript. So that was some of the things that we thought about during this process, because you're like, okay, how am I going to, you know, if you decide to enable this, how am I going to update your site? I can't, but I can tell you where the file is going to reside. And I can put a dummy file in there for the first 3 to 5 minutes and then replace it with the actual. Yeah.
And is that something that will, because I can't imagine that it would be something that would be retroactive for previous episodes.
You are going to get about what it is if you on a $20 plan, I believe right now you get 400 megs of storage a month. So you're essentially going to get 400 minutes of translation each month we're going to do a flat rate of $10. So you could potentially go back. Now we are going to make the option available if you want to essentially do bulk. Let's say you want to go back and do all your prior inventory.
Yeah.
We'll bill that to you separately. We'll say, okay, this is how much it's going to cost. We'll turn that on for you and initiate the transcripts. But, initially, the way this is being rolled out is you get whatever your plan is, 400, 800, or 1600 megs of storage.
Yeah.
You will get the equivalent number of minutes of actual translation. And for those folks that are at the 16, I shouldn't say this, but those are at the 1600 minute or 1600 megs, we actually lose money on this because the translation is not inexpensive.
No, it isn't. The actual software and the time to render it out and everything is intensive.
And we pay by the hour, and we're going to give a flat rate of $10 per month. And then for this service as an add-on on top of your current hosting bill. And then additionally, if you, again, want that backlog, we can do it. But, and it's a numbers game. So, and what we're trying to do is get adoption. I'm not trying to make this a profit center. I'm trying to make this an adoption, make it so it's easy for people to adopt. So if you want your shows accessible, it's essentially 10 bucks a month.
Well. And I mean, the thing is you can absolutely use Blueberry PowerPress, everything else without having a full on monthly plan, that kind of stuff.
We hope you come over and host with us.
Absolutely. You guys have some fantastic hosting options, especially network hosting options.
Those are on networks. Those are building networks. A lot of great tools there. Now, one thing I will say is those folks that are on a pro plan that have ad insertion and if they're doing a pre-roll or mid, they cannot participate in programmatic at the same time. Those two platforms don't mix.
Well, I like the programmatic option because I mean, you and I have attended some of the same conferences, things like that. And the one thing that I tell podcasters more than anything, especially whenever I'm speaking at like Comic Palooza, that kind of stuff, is you go Podcorn, things like that all day long. If you want, that is a numbers game and that's a big numbers game.
Yeah.
You know, like you need to be getting like a zero and a comma. For some numbers to really have eyes for for sponsor yeah. money. However, yeah. if you go local and you find a local business that's within the niche of your podcast right, and you go to right. them, hey, you yep. could be making $100 a month licks all day long for shouting them out, putting links up on your yep. website, hashtagging them in socials. Like I sell more ads for my show off my social media pull than I do off my actual numbers.
And with the programmatic, what we did in the initial go round here was I tested this for about 90 days on my personal show before and had a whole bunch of, you know, feedback from my audience. I made them the testers and finding out relevancy and everything out, then working with a partner. But we decided to exclude politics, gambling, religion, adult, alcohol, vaping, and cannabis as categories. So those are automatically excluded. Now,
the first three are big ones too. Those are ones that if you put them into your random ads, like they're going to pay 2-3 times more than your average ad.
So those categories, at least for the first probably 3 months, will be excluded. Then we'll make it available where you'll be able to go in and opt in or opt out. There's like 40 categories.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to go in and cherry pick. You say, I only want from agriculture. I only want from tech. I only want from food. You'll be able to go in and cherry pick the categories you want. My inclination is we'll just say, here's the ones you should exclude.
Yeah.
And, you know, some shows are probably going to be okay with alcohol. Some shows are going to be cool with vaping. Sure. Some shows are going to be good with cannabis. Some are going to be good with gambling. Some will be saying, bring on the politicians. It really depends on
yeah.
the content. But I think in this first go, in order to get, you know, to really alleviate the, you know, because those are probably the hot categories of adult, you know, some people are not going to want adult content on their shows.
Yeah.
So those are the hot categories that we've excluded. And I'm sure we're going to immediately get some pushback. Say, hey, I want weed commercials. And we're going to be like, it's coming. You'll be able to opt into that yeah. in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know on other platforms, you can go through and select what you want. I know on mine, like I was saying, mine's full throttle on my monetized platforms.
Sure.
If you want my show without commercials, except for my baked ins, like my 5 minutes in the middle between guests,
right.
feel free to hop on by and subscribe. Download directly from my website. That's what it's there for.
That's some of the new stuff for taking the podcast movement.
That's awesome.
Podcast, and we're talking about that. We've made a video to loop through because we just spent 2 years rebuilding the platform. And so it's really looking forward to the show and getting back and talking to podcasters. I'm doing a live event Friday at 11 Eastern on newmediashow.com/live. We're going to have Rob Greenlee and I are going to have 4 panelists up there. It's going to be a great panel, including Adam Curry and part of the Podcast 2.0 group. And then I'm speaking once. I've got a session of my own that I'm presenting. So, yeah, it's going to be a great show.
Yeah, absolutely. I am happy to see that and so many other conferences coming back around. Happy to see folks like you and Rob back out there in the thick of things, talking to podcasters and bringing up these really, really important topics at conferences like podcasting privacy, things like that, where you get to sit on panels with big name folks from other platforms and truly call them to task on it, you know?
Yeah.
Because it really is an important topic. The more that, because I'm like you, I'm all about any alternative source of media, any being able to get out there and say what you want. But you got to be careful whenever you are the consumer out there, whenever you're the one encouraging people to come to a platform, you need to be educated about what you're doing. So thank you so much for your time in this very, very busy preparation for the upcoming Podcast Movement Conference, as well as all these releases, Todd.
You know, what's funny is the Slack message just come through ready to test. So
Awesome.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And those that want to reach out to me, it's Todd@blueberry.com, blueberry.com without the E's, because we couldn't afford the E's. So, yeah, thanks, Russ, for having me on.
Hey, forever and always, hold the line real quick while we close things out. While you are online checking out everything from Todd Cochran and Blueberry, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is your home for all of the episodes, all the content. You can download the free app. You can go play the Curious Realm Lottery, the 24/7 page. Hop on by. It will play you a random episode of Curious Realm. You never know what it's going to play. We also have the Knowledge Vault. Knowledge Vault's where you can find all kinds of great declassified documents, UFO and paranormal, scientific studies, constitutional civil rights, hack documents, all kinds of stuff. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.